In the words of the great Malcolm Tucker, good morning, my little chicks and cocks, and welcome to the 94th, count them, 94 episodes of the great linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread, brought to you by the vassals of King's Graves. The longest running reread of A Song of Ice and Fire in existence, I would have thought. I don't know, actually, because maybe the podcast of Ice and Fire one is longer, but this one has definitely waded further, deeper, more painfully through the books than anyone else. My name is Bina 007. I'm going to be your host today as we continue with our traverse through Dance with Dragons. And for all of you haters out there, I'm here to say that we have three absolutely superb chapters today. They really remind you, as I said to Vali on the forums, how good George R. R. Martin is at writing. And he responded cynically, how good he was at writing 8 years ago. Anyway, on that slightly ambiguous note, let's get into the episode. I am joined today by the lovely Hannah.
Hi, it's Shadow Baby on the forums.
By the equally lovely Queen James.
Hello, I'm James.
James, we have to talk at the end of this episode about all the Queer Eye books and merchandising that's coming out.
Oh my God, I know. It's so good.
To the lovely Mikal, who I met in New York last week, which was just a delight.
That ink is right on the forums, and I had the best time ever.
Thank you so much. The best taxi service in all of Queens. We were going to be joined by Michael Kalbadegi. Sadly, he's not going to join us today. I think later we will be joined by Mary Nymeria, but for not.
I'm here, actually.
Oh, you're here. Okay, wonderful.
Yeah. I appeared during your introduction.
As if by magic.
Hi, everyone. It's Mary. Yeah, Nymeria on the forums.
Fantastic. And we are also joined by Jock.
Hello, Manlo Jock, too on the forums.
Yay, the gang is all here. Perfect. Okie dokie, so today, as I said, we have three amazing chapters. We ended the last episode, hosted by Adam, with Kevin telling Cersei about Myrcella's mutilation on June 14th. In this episode, we're going to cover the Prince of Winterfell, aka Theon IV, the King's Prize, aka Arsha II, and Cersei II from A Dance with Dragons. And they really bounce around these chapters. One of them is at the end of the first volume of my two-volume paperback edition. One is just at the start of the second, and one is almost like three quarters of the way through the second. So the linear reread is really taking us around and about. These events take place between June 14th and June 19th. At the same time, but off screen, we know that John Connington has sent his letter to Dawn. The Northerners are marching from Barrowtown in the super long Reek 3, Theon 3 chapter, and Aegon arrives at Griffin's Roost in the super long John Con chapter. So there's lots going on even outside of the scope of these three chapters. As usual, just before we get into it, we will be spoiling anything potentially from A Song of Ice and Fire. If there's anything T-Wowy, not sure there will be, but we'll clearly signpost it and put it at the end. And we won't be spoiling Game of Thrones, the show, except potentially in the after show. And again, that will be clearly signposted. Okie dokie. So with that, I think we can get into The Prince of Winterfell / Theon IV. And it's Hannah with the chapter summary.
I found it very hard to tackle summarizing this chapter. It contains some extremely brutal subject matter. And I really couldn't come up with anything when I tried to write that felt suitably sensitive or respectful. This chapter is a two-sided coin. On the one side, there's a completely sick game of a sadistic or psychopathic sex sadist and his victim, one who is being made complicit in the abuse of the next victim. And on the other side of the coin, there's this backdrop of a marionette political sideshow going on. Theon is being paraded around for the Boltons' northern takeover, while Reek is being forced to lure a lamb to the slaughter. And it is some of George's best writing, so I think I'll just go to the notes and let it speak for itself. So basically the major beats in this chapter are obviously the marriage of Arya, Jane Poole, to Ramsay. And then there's a very interesting dinner after that in the Great Hall of Winterfell. We also have an interesting moment in the Godswood with Theon. And then there's all the shit that happens at the very end, which I don't feel I have the metal to talk about. So
yeah,
I'm not sure where we're going to start.
I think that's actually a very good introduction, because there are two things going on, right? There's the sadistic psychosexual games that Ramsay's inflicting on Reek, Theon, and Jane. But then there is a lot of proper political stuff going on about the Northern Lords. And for those people out there who believe in the Grand Northern Conspiracy with Wyman Manderly, you know, dishing out potentially a Frey Pie and Lady Barbary Dustin potentially getting quite, you know, squiffy and maybe revealing too much about her plans to Theon, or Theon correctly realizing that she's the only block in the path of Roose and Ramsay. There's a lot of really good political stuff going on as well. But it's amazing writing, and George is a great horror writer. So the wedding, the bedding ceremony is all really horrific.
Yeah, this chapter, when I read it, it reminded me of, like, we don't have them here, but overseas you guys have those huge roundabouts where all these directions of traffic come together and start circling, you know, and it reminded me of that. Like, it's not just an intersection of a lot of different threads and themes from the book, but this, like, tempest swirling starting, you know.
But we can tackle it. We can tackle it in topic order, right? So let's start. Let's build ourselves up to the Jane Poole stuff. Let's start first with the Grand Northern Conspiracy. I guess at this point, is everyone a believer in the Frey Pie theory? There's an interesting point where Theon is saying, I don't think that Wyman Manderly is as much of a coward as everyone. I mean, Theon's actually got quite good political, he's quite politically astute. Do you think this is known now? Do you think it's just canon, like R plus L equals J?
I think so.
How do you feel?
Three Freys, three pies, the rat cook, the very lurid descriptions.
Yeah, it's laid on pretty heavily.
Yeah.
And they and Theon, you know, also realizes, you know, when she tells him that, you know, well, I mean, Roose isn't eating anything that, you know, Lord Manderly hasn't eaten first, and drinking anything that, you know, he hasn't drunk of. Like, so they know that, like, they're not trusting him either. Also, I will point out on the food reference, I had to look up what a neep was again. I always forget that's a turnip.
Yeah, there's a lot of neeps in these three chapters. Neeps appear later as well. Yeah, I mean, I think it was like the first half of the chapter, I'm like, why would you yourself be cannibalistic and eat the pie? Then I realized the point when he says Roose won't eat anything unless Wyman eats it. So, but Wyman eats it with great relish, which I just find really just grim.
It's very disturbing, yeah, like, right?
We love him, but also that.
I don't know. I think, like, God, how could you? Maybe it's because I don't eat meat.
yeah. Same here. But so, I think...
Because Abel is there and he asks for that song from Abel, one of my notes was, do they know each other? Does he know that he's there?
No.
Because, like... I mean,
that would be too much, right? He just asks for the song because he's, like, having his own private joke here, and he's really happy with it, and no one else knows, and he's like, hey, you're eating your relatives, and there's actually a song in the background that fits whatever is happening
here. Yeah, he's the most pleased with himself right there.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So it also has to do with a king and the wall, right? That song. And I wondered if it's like some kind of signal. That either knew Mance from before and recognized him, or that he knew someone was going to come and it was a signal.
I really don't think so. I think, if anyone would know Mance Rayder, it would be other lords closer to the actual wall and the north, and I don't think anyone knows him here. And, I mean... It doesn't have to be,
right.
Why?
Mance wouldn't be having a reason to trust Wyman, right? Like,
yeah,
he wouldn't come out and reveal himself. So I think that's the only way that goes down. And I don't think that happened.
Yeah, they're not allies.
I kind of thought this song was just kind of like George's way of mirroring the Red Wedding, you know, when they're playing the Rings of Castamere during the Red Wedding. So let's play the Rat Cook while I'm feeding you your relatives.
And it mirrors the Red Wedding even on a meta level, because at the Red Wedding, the band is not what it seems. You know, they're playing badly because they're not really a band in here. The band is a proper group of musicians, but again, they're not what they seem. When did you guys realize this was Mance Rayder? Can you even remember the first time you read this? Because I had no clue it was Mance Rayder.
I didn't think I ever did. Like, realize it was Mance Rayder.
Until the internet's revealed
it. Until I got online. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was very much relying on the web to tell me what was actually going on.
You don't know by now, right? That it's him for sure. Like, in the writing, there is a point where you should know, but it's not yet.
Yeah, Jock, do you want to just say the point you were making on the chat?
The one bit of evidence that you might know about Mance would be that Robert Glover is on his side and Stannis has just taken Deepwood Motte, but I don't think information could be transferred that far.
Cool.
Well, we've already done the whole thing with Davos being there.
Yes.
So he would know just from that alone.
Not sure. Anyway, so I think almost more interestingly than Wyman Mandler eating a fray pie, just because we all know about it by now, is Lady Barbary Dustin. He's having this really interesting conversation with Theon about the Boltons, and like she really hates the Maesters, right? I wonder if anything will come of that, on the idea that they have outsized power. And there's this point at which, if she'd have been allowed to speak on, she might have said something more, but then Theon's taken away for the bedding. This is just George presumably laying some groundwork for a Grand Northern conspiracy, right? Or what are your feelings about Lady Barbary Dustin and her sort of motivations?
I don't know about her. Like, her theory makes sense logically and so forth. Like, her evidence is that she couldn't marry someone 20 years ago. I'm not sure whether or not if she's just, like, coming up with excuses or and rationalizing her actions or what her character is.
Same. On my notes, all I had was Barbary Dustin? Question mark. So it's like, what to say about her?
I don't know. She strikes me as quite bitter and really just angry with the world and with the Starks especially. And I'm not sure she's really more than she appears to be. I don't know.
Well, she does seem petty, but she also seems quite clever as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm missing something. I feel like I might have had this realization that she was more and then forgot about it. But she just seems really bitter about, what's his name? Ned's brother and
Landon.
Yeah, that's it. I think what's his name Stark works here, but we'll go with Brandon. I don't know. This conversation is quite weird because it's really open and frank, but it seems quite resigned to me as well. Like, whatever, I might as well tell you anything because you're useless and you're not going to be of use to anyone.
Well, maybe it's, you know, the book Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, where they had the fake telegraph, use that to figure out who knew what. Well, maybe it's the same sort of thing, just with Lucy's in her circle. Like, to try and gauge how, like, so Ramsay is to Luce,
right,
or to Ramsay and so forth.
Well, maybe it's just that she recognises, and, you know, there's so few people she can speak to who know the true nature of Ramsay and who more than Reek, and the fact that he does make the odd astute comment about her position makes her think. It must be very hard in that situation where you're being so careful politically to not be able to ever talk to anyone. And she just has a few glasses of wine and thinks, this is my guy.
I also wonder if, like, it might be for Barbary Dustin in general, I kind of think that her story is a balance between how much she's, like, her own personal vengeance and what she decides she's willing to, like, how much that dovetails with what's actually good for, like, the Stark cause, maybe against her own will, because she's definitely not like, oh yay, the Boltons are amazing, you know. So I kind of wonder if her talks with Theon are like maybe attempts to tease one of the like Bolton pieces over to her own side, and Theon is kind of like, I think, too scared to really understand if that's what's going on, you know, because he's like, I mean, he takes everything almost at like very face value, like sentence by sentence. And yeah, then, you know, she's kind of like laying this, you know, even in the crypt and everything, she talks to him too much for me to think that she's just like, oh, I'll just, yeah, it's been a long day, I'll spill my troubles to this kid, you know.
I think it's probably more that George needed to convey some information to us as readers, and that was a slightly clumsy way of doing it, about stirrings in the north and dissatisfaction and
character that's too afraid to pass it on to anyone and do anything with the information.
Yeah, exactly. But for those for those of you or the listeners who are curious about the Grand Northern Conspiracy, if you go back into the mists of time to VOK 51, which was published scarily in 2013, there's actually a Feast Dance episode on the Grand Northern Conspiracy, so you can listen to people like Duncan and Zach and Nadia debating what the Grand Northern Conspiracy is and who's involved, it was a really good episode from memory, so I'd recommend it.
And since we still don't have a new book, it holds up.
Oh, that's so depressing. Recorded in 2013.
was one of the first I listened to from Vok, and I had never heard that theory before.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever heard it before until I think Duncan mentioned it. So
in
those days, the theories were all new and fresh and exciting. I actually don't think
there wasn't like 100 different podcasts and YouTube channels like theorizing everything. It was just like you like one Reddit thread, and you're like, have you guys read the one Reddit thread? You know.
Yeah.
Can we go back to pies for a second?
Yes, you can.
So I had a note that said Big Walder is suspicious of Lord Manderly. He's expecting him to arrive with Frey hostages at Winterfell, but they never made it past Barrowton. Aren't these the same dudes that Lady Stoneheart has brought to her?
No.
They're not the same three guys.
No, it's not. It's the treasurer of the Simon and Lager, I think.
There's so many random phrases, it's easy to kind of lose them.
Yeah. Isn't there 92 or something along there?
But these are the ones that were at, you know, his court, and they were coming with them along the same path from White Harbor.
Yeah, to negotiate a betrothal with his granddaughter.
Okay. I was just thinking, though, if perhaps she was involved, that'd be some real interesting plausible deniability for him. And I could see Joel.
Yeah, and I do love how pleased all the Freys are with themselves after the Red Wedding. And like, you know, everything's coming up Frey everywhere they go, you know. But it's not going to end well, so.
Everything's coming up Frey. That should be the episode title. Okay, let's move on from the pies and the Grand Northern Conspiracy to the events of the night. And let's start off first just with Theon / Reek, because we get it's a really lovely POV. It's beautifully written. And if we just do the bit before the wedding ceremony, so when he's putting the cloak on Jane Poole and he's just absolutely petrified that he'll let it slip that she isn't Arya, and he's obviously still incredibly scared of Ramsay, but then he goes into the Godswood and you see all his memories of being there, of various sexual exploits from a different time, and kind of some bitterness about when he was being trained and when he was, you know, a ward / prisoner. Like he says, he was treated kindly, but it was always with an iron sword behind it. And then you hear the spooky kind of the whispering of his name, which is kind of reminding him that he is Theon. So there's a lot of really interesting, I guess, psychological stuff about where Theon is regarding his own identity. So I guess my first question is, do you think the voice saying Theon is Bran?
Yes.
And the evidence is, or is it just a feeling?
Well, I do, it's kind of just a feeling, but I think it's telling that the moment that he sees that, he automatically goes to the day that he took Winterfell as his next memory. And so I don't know if that's either like George's writing just to say, kind of connect the two, or if it's, you know, he may have heard Bran's voice. He just doesn't recognize that it is Bran's voice, made him think of Bran. And then he goes to that day because it seems like the next two lines are about the day he took Winterfell.
Yeah. And that gives us the chapter title, right? The Prince of Winterfell. And he's saying, you know, I made myself a prince, because I was thinking when I started reading it, you know, Ramsay is the Lord, or Roose is the Lord of Winterfell. And he's very, in a sense, clear-sighted. I think there's a real self-awareness about his mistakes, but also about how others have treated him. I think if you want to sympathize with Theon, of course, he suffered horrible torture, so you start sympathizing with him before this. But I think there's something about his real acceptance of what he's done and his mistakes, and his empathy for Jane and his fear really are very moving here. Any other thoughts on Theon in this section?
Yeah, I mean, so Ramsay is the one that also says, like, you know, hey, you're the Prince of Winterfell, so, you know, you should have the right to have the first night, like when he teases him and all that. I just think it's so amazing that at this point, like when he has the knife out and Ramsay's like, oh, just cut the dress off because it'll be faster. And he's like, I could do it. I could just stab him. But oh, no, it's a trick. He'll get me. But he probably at that point, he probably could. You know what I mean?
And that's, you know, a real death wish there as well. Like, he's like, if I slit her wrist at her neck at the wedding feast at a dance, then he'll kill me and I don't care about dying. And it's incredibly dark, the idea that by killing her he'd be doing her a favor and then he would die too, and all this horror would end.
Right. I mean, at that point he could take her life, he could take his life, he could probably kill Ramsay, or at least, you know, deliver a pretty good blow. I mean, he's right there. I mean, you know, he wouldn't get out of the room, obviously, but you know, I think Ramsay is so confident that he's broken him. And we see before we see how he's been broken, and then it's revealed who he is. And here, I mean, I think we even though we've seen that through several chapters already, like, I think this is where we get like the final extent of it. Like, even here, he has a chance really to just to be done, and he can't even take it.
I'm not sure I completely agree, because I think even though Ramsay knows he's broken and he's confident, he is, he's still teasing him about it. And the fact that he is teasing him means that he is also on his guard. And Theon could never really strike at Ramsay.
I'm sure that he's on his guard. But I mean, you know, it's one of those things where if you're, you know, so as overconfident he is as to hand someone a loaded gun and be like, he's not going to shoot me. Like, they could, you know.
Except, well, it's not a loaded gun. It's a it's a knife, and
right.
And you've got time to just break the. I mean, Theon is quite weak, and I'm pretty sure. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure if he actually tried, he would fail.
I mean, he might, but I feel like Ramsay's undressing and all that. Like, I'm just saying he's as vulnerable as he's ever going to be to mm-hmm. Theon in this moment, you know, and he's got a knife in his hand. And Theon recognizes that and is still too afraid to do anything. I think this would have been his best shot.
Well, because that's what it is, right? Like, when you brainwash someone, you keep them, you make them create, like, you don't have to imprison them anymore because they create their own prison. And that's what the like mental cycle is over and over and over again. And there's, I thought, like, a really interesting inconsistency in Theon's kind of the way he's thinking about potential escape, because he's like, you know, Jane, she has to remember her name. It's Arya. She's Arya. And then he actually wants her to say, you know, he's giving her those lines. And he's thinking them. And then at the wedding, he's like, oh, she should say that she's not Arya. She should say that she's Jane Poole. And that would stop everything. He'd kill her, but, you know, it would be better. And, you know, there's this, you know, and later on, he thinks the opposite again. And it's this kind of pattern of thought that, like, he's almost expecting other people, like, he talks about how he can't save anyone, he can't even save himself. He's sort of expecting salvation to come from her in a weird kind of way. And I just actually think that it, usually Theon's inconsistency drives me nuts, but I think this is really psychologically astute, and it makes a lot of sense that he's basically, you know, like, when he gets, like, he wants the trap to open, but every time it's possible that the trap will open, he closes it again, not to reference a certain scene from Game of Thrones, but, like, it's that's exactly right. What he's going through.
It's like the scene, The Color Purple, where he makes Ceely shave him, and, like, they both know she could cut his throat at any time.
It's a total power play, isn't it? There's a similar scene in Schindler's List.
And it almost always backfires eventually. I mean, think about these people. Like, there's been several stories over the years of, you know, like, girls that were abducted, and then the people that abducted them, they kept them locked and chained. And eventually, they don't anymore. They basically give them run of the house, and they go out of the house and run errands, but they're too afraid to leave until eventually they aren't, you know, which is what happens eventually. But, you know, because at a certain point, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's like you've manipulated them and damaged them enough that, you know, they're just, you've convinced them that, you know, I don't need chains. I don't need to be here watching you. I'm always watching you.
They probably get off too on, like, well, that's getting boring. And so they ratchet up the stakes by taking that risk. You know,
right. And Ramsay would definitely be one of those guys that, like, you know, how far I can push it makes it more fun for him.
Yeah, if he trusted Theon completely and was completely, you know, contrite with him, then it wouldn't be fun anymore.
Well, that's why Ramsay is so unpredictable and keeps, you know, changing things, that he, like, the only thing Theon can count on, like, psychologically, he's almost relying on Ramsay to continue being the psychopath, because otherwise, you know, it's very unnerving for him that he's dressed as Theon and he's, you know, in good clothing, because he knows, like, oh, it's just gonna go right back. Like, there's the only thing he can rely upon is Ramsay fucking him over, and it's messed up in the
I think it's interesting the way he projects that onto Jane too, and is like, you know, Jane, it rhymes with pain, like, come on, get on, you know, he's like, just get on board, you know, come on. It's just weird.
It's very
so weird. I mean, because
I don't know,
he's made him dress up as Theon, right?
Yeah,
but he also feels like he's going to be punished for it later.
But that's what's beautiful about this chapter, like, dressing him up as Theon, making him go through this ceremony in the Godswood, it stirs up so many memories for Theon, and it's what gives you hope for him, that you can see him fight, like, getting back to himself, but he's on a knife's edge, and he goes back to Reek, back and forth, it's what makes the writing so good and convincing. I don't know if any of you have watched Surviving R. Kelly, which is obviously incredibly disturbing to watch, but some of what happens at the end of this chapter, or even the way in which Theon slash Reek sort of kids Jane and says, just, you know, he's fine, just appease him and he won't hurt you. And then obviously the very complicit act that he performs at the end of the chapter really reminded me of stuff that goes on in Surviving R. Kelly, where he'll brainwash, manipulate, sexually exploit one woman or one girl, underage girl, so it's real exploitation, and then turn her into someone who will recruit and exploit another girl and do so with him. And it just felt so true to life, so real. I mean, it's just one of the things that impresses you about George, that he can so convincingly get into the minds of these really awful people. But even I think reading it at the time, maybe I thought it was a bit outlandish, or a bit, I don't know, like it's almost better to convince yourself that it's outlandish. But having watched Surviving R. Kelly, I think it's probably incredibly realistic.
Yeah,
sadly.
That's a good point. I watched that like maybe a month ago, because everyone had been talking about it, and it's a lot of the same tactics, because it having a victim as like kind of an ally also helps ease your other victims into it. Gives you credibility almost.
Absolutely. And there's something about how, you know, Ramsay, it's made very explicit that he needs Theon to validate fake Arya as Arya, because none of the other Northern Lords necessarily know what she looks like. But he also does need her a little bit to pacify Jane, although that's not made as explicit. But Reek definitely takes on that role, at any rate. But he does care. I mean, like, you know, when he's telling her, like, don't do anything. Don't try and cover your breasts. Don't antagonize him. It's heartbreaking. He's in a prison. He's both an abuser and an abused, and it's just horrific.
The other thing that I would ask is, you know, keep in mind is that she was also trained in the brothels by Littlefinger, so you would think that like she would be someone that's like gotten used to this a little bit, and it's still like really creepy and freaking her out. Like that's kind of how bad this is.
And there is a theme. I mean, these chapters are very far apart in the book, but there is a theme as you go through about women who have been used, abused, exploited, do or don't live up to men's views of what they should be. I mean, Jane Poole's story is one of the worst in these books of many horrible stories.
But, well, there was actually one line that stood out to me that I don't know, like, it's not even nearly at, like, the most depressing point of the chapter, but it's when Theon's, like, walking Jane through the Godswood, and he is like, oh, well, maybe we're all in hell, and Stannis killed us, and we just didn't notice. And he says, is the battle yet to come, or has it been fought and lost? And to me, that's just, like, horribly applicable to so many things. And you know, by the time you get to the end of the chapter, even just within the context of the story, it's like it feels like the battle has been lost, because it's, you know, Theon is participating in this horrible, you know, rape and violation of an innocent girl. But you know, it like these three chapters are so draining and so emotional and so difficult that it does kind of feel like, you know, I mean, on a meta level, I was honestly a little bit like, what state of mind was George in, like, when he wrote this? Like, God, you know, like the early aughts were tough, but like, oh man.
But they were tough. And if you look at some of the media that was created in that time, you know, in the shadow of 9/11 and the war, things like the Battlestar Galactica reboot, there's some very dark stuff that comes out of that time. I think what's interesting is if we knew when he wrote these individual chapters, because of course, as I said, in the books, this is like almost beginning, middle and end of Dance with Dragons. So they just happen to take place together. But again, just give us a really... I mean, it shows his powers of writing, they're beautifully written, and his powers of empathy. And also that, sadly, I think this is plausible. I think this is the way that psychological abusers work. I think what Reek does at the end, so fearful of his life. But it's bizarrely, it's the moment of his, it's almost his lowest moment, right? Other than, I guess, torching or doing his coup at Winterfell. This is his lowest personal moment. But it's also, I find the chapter where I see there are moments of hope, because he is finding his humanity and he's finding his Theon-ness and his self-awareness. And it's just amazing. Out of that utter darkness is going to come his, hopefully, his redemption.
I mean, this chapter runs you through a lot of emotions. There's excitement and depression and horror, anguish,
political intrigue,
the feeling of retribution, right? You know, I don't know. I guess kind of a little off the topic of all the uncomfortable stuff. What if Theon had just said, "Oh, that's Jane Poole," like, you know, and we know he's not going to do that. But what would have happened?
He dies, she dies. But what do the Northern houses do?
Yeah, that's the more important part. I don't know if he necessarily dies or just like goes back and is tortured, but if he just, because if he's in front of everyone, and the other lords don't, you know, condone what Ramsay does for sure, but if he just says, "Look, this is not Arya. I know Arya. I know who this is. This is Jane Poole, and he's going to kill me for saying this. He's already tortured me. He's already, you know," if somehow he had the courage to do all that, like, what would they do?
I'm not sure it would change that much, because, like, for now, the Northmen don't have anyone to really turn their allegiance to. They're kind of waiting for that. And there's maybe this great Northern conspiracy, and Manderly knows that the two younger Stark boys are alive and is waiting on for them to show up. And until then, even if he knows it's not Arya, what can he really do? Like, he has no one to really raise in rebellion for.
Yeah, I don't think within the walls of Winterfell anything happens, but I mean, do like some of the lords just like storm off and go back home?
I mean,
like,
presumably
the snow.
There's only two things that can go down, and that's there. It's an all-out bloodbath right there, and they probably are still beaten by the Bolton men, or everyone is like, "Yes, so."
I think it's nod and smile, give him another daughter from another northern house, bide your time, and then strike back. I don't think anything happens on the day.
And Bruce probably just blames the Lannisters and says, "Well, the Lannisters sent me here.
I never met her. I didn't know. I've been tricked by the Lannisters."
And it would actually happen what is already happening, which is murders in Winterfell and someone walking in the shadows, and that wouldn't change anything to the feelings of the Northern lords. Like, they already hate Bolton, basically, and they still find no real reason to act as yet, at least not act openly. I don't think knowing that this is Jane Poole and not Arya would change that.
It is so fascinating, actually, because you think about what an unstable situation this is, and like, everybody involved knows that this is an unstable situation, especially Roose Bolton, and maybe Ramsay doesn't.
None of them are stupid, like, right?
I mean, yeah, and Manderly is so fascinating also, because he is, you know, like, I like the guy, I'm rooting for him, but he's also so calculating, and he is not going to make a move before he can get the maximum benefit from it. And like, he's absolutely not on the, like, "Oh, save the Ned's daughter" train. He's just like, "Yeah, you know, whatever. Too bad. We'll see what happens next. And I'm going to get my own personal revenge and, you know, have my little, you know, Stark King in the North afterward." But it is fascinating to me that, like, it needs the right kind of trigger, because everybody is like very, like, slowly but quickly completely losing their shit, especially when the murders start happening. But I agree that Arya or Jane being revealed as Arya would not have been enough of a destabilizing force.
I completely agree. It was interesting. I haven't read these chapters since the original Feast Dance reread, so in a long time. And what was shocking to me is, I think in my head I had some visualization as the people organizing the Grand Northern Conspiracy as our heroes, because we're on the side of the Starks and they're going to avenge the Starks and make it all okay.
Right.
And then you read this and you think, well, why Manderly is a bitter cannibalistic, he's quite sadistic in his own way, getting the singer to sing the song, and then Barbary Dustin's a very bitter, gnarly, twisted, you know, these people who I thought of as, you know, I think we have this kind of romantic image of the Northern lords as being
the noble Northern.
The noble Northerners rather than the soft, cunning Southerners. And it's not the case. They're as twisted and bitter and horrid. I mean, if these are the people we're relying on, I don't know. Does proxy marriage exist in this world, says Hannah? Don't know, maybe.
It does on the Iron Islands, because Yara Asha gets married by a seal.
They could just go, "So we're just, obviously it's not, we're doing this by proxy," you know, like, they could feign any kind of innocence and have it.
But yeah, I was just about to ask, like, is Manderly kind of like what's, even with, if he gets, you know, Rickon back, what's, what's the plan? Like, is he like looking to control him, or is he like really looking to restore the Starks and be a good Bannerman? Or
no, he's looking. I mean, it's a little boy, right? So I think the Grand Northern conspiracy is to install him, but ultimately rule as a very powerful small council, right?
Maybe install him from White Harbor and kind of keep him there until he's grown.
Yeah, because Winterfell, I mean, you really see that in this chapter, that Winterfell is still basically a wreck. It's pullulating with bodies, but they've hastily put up a front
gate.
They
can rebuild in the spring.
But it's, you know, Winterfell is not a seat of power that's really functional. I mean, the Boltons have to be there because it's symbolic. But if you were actually Northern Lords running the North, you'd probably take Rickon off to a more functional castle and do it from there until he could rebuild.
The Winter Town was raised, right?
Mm. Yeah, I don't think that's functional either.
I thought the plan was that Rickon was going to ride in on a unicorn and kill everybody.
Look, didn't have anything to do with King. It. I said this
Listen,
before.
That's Rickon's plan.
George knows better. George, yeah. George will make it happen. Okay.
He's going to teleport into the Godswood on a narwhal.
He's going to be Rickon, first of his name, the feral wolf.
I feel that at this point, the podcast gods are telling me that when we mention narwhals, it's time to segue into the next chapter.
Narwhals are real.
Yes, they are
real. I didn't know that until like a couple months ago.
Until he met Matt Varley. Oh, dear. Anyway.
Not my fault they're branded as ocean unicorns.
Indeed. They're awesome.
Yeah, Matt keeps one in his backyard pool. It's above ground. It's humane.
Okay. So after Theon 4, we jump over four chapters to get to Asha 2, the King's Prize. It takes place 2 days later on June 16th. And in the absence of Carl Wodegi, I'm just going to quickly run through the chapter summary from, I assume, Tower of the Hand or Westeros.org or one of the wonderful places on the internets where you get these things. Stannis' host departs from Deepwood Motte. Asha is chained and carried on at the back of the baggage train under guard by Alysanne Mormont. Stannis means to bring her to Winterfell to show off the Kraken's daughter as his captive and as a sign of his strength. They believe the 300-mile march through the Wolfswood should take them about 15 days to Winterfell. Asha bent her knee at Deepwood Mott, but thinks to herself that others have bent the knee before, such as Balon, who rose again to fight another day. Wise advice years earlier from her father. As part of her surrender, she hopes that Stannis will spare the rest of the Ironborn their lives, which he does, imprisoning them at Deepwood Mott. She listens to talk between the Northmen, seeing their pride in their king, though she predicts many, if not all, will die in the siege at Winterfell. Sir Justin Massey takes a courteous nature with Asha, treating her well, and she believes he's after her lands, but takes his company and indeed food over being left alone. After a few nights, she's brought to Stannis and tries to treat with him. She says that his brother Robert was renowned for turning foes into friends, but the mention of Robert just angers Stannis. The snow begins to take a toll on the passage of the southern men. However, the Northmen are used to this weather and proceed quickly, apparently in snowshoes. Later, she hears the Queensmen, worshippers of the Lords of Light, begin to contemplate a sacrifice to appease their god and blow the storm away. But Stannis doesn't listen to them, nor does he listen to the pleas to make camp and wait out the storm. So after 15 days, they have only made the distance through 9 days of storm. After 30 days, they have yet to reach Winterfell. Morgan Little, the man who nearly slayed her at Deepwood Motte, comes to apologise, but only after calling her a cunt, not for calling her a cunt. Later, they reach a small crofter's village where they make camp and try to catch some fish. Asha realises that Stannis is now a gaunt figure, having lost much weight on the march. They are encamped and locked in by snow, unable to move. Worse, they have almost no provisions and are starving. So it's a really brutal chapter just about people being defeated by weather. And the whole time I was reading this, and I thought it was brilliantly written and so evocative, I was just reminded of Napoleon having quote-unquote won the Battle of Borodino and taken Moscow, just being stranded with this grand Napoleonic army and being effectively defeated by the Russian winter and trying to retreat back to Western Europe and just losing all his men and horses and starving, and this grand noble army just being reduced to sort of just absolute piteous ruin.
It's actually a saying in France.
Really?
we say it's the Berezina, basically, to say it's like a debacle, everyone is dying. I mean, figuratively. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I've read so many histories of that, and as I was reading this, I was like, this must have been what it was like.
Yeah, it's a good point. I hadn't thought of that, but that's exactly it. Yeah.
Just because they fought, I mean, in a sense, that was the same. I know this is meant to be more medieval, but it's the same kind of war, isn't it? Because it's long marches, horses, you've got to keep provisions and food. It's effectively the same thing.
Yeah.
Same issue. And also the idea that having this army of different types of people, and that's what Napoleon And all the people fighting him always had, you know, these patchwork armies of people from different areas with different outfits and militaristic training and different loyalties sometimes, and trying to keep them together. And eventually people kind of drift apart. And, you know, when everything's going well, it's fine. And when everything's not going well, the bitchiness comes across, you know, the Northmen calling the Southerners like soft for not coping with the snow and whatnot. Anyway, that's enough for me. Other people's thoughts on this chapter?
I just don't understand how they were so poorly provisioned when they were leaving. I know they only thought that they were going to be on the road for 15 days and it turned out to be like 35. But still, I mean, you'd think that you would leave with more provisions to last you.
But I don't think you're going to leave with double your estimate, because that's just all weight, isn't it? Weight and horses and...
I guess, but maybe after, you know, the first 2 weeks, you know, after the first week and a half, you start to ration things a little better. I just think the way that they describe Stannis after the 35 days as being so gaunt and you know, how much weight he lost and how terrible he looks, I just imagine, you know, how bad his men are doing. He's the king, you know, so if he looks that shitty.
Well, although he starts with nothing on him.
Stannis looks shitty no matter what.
Yeah.
He starts skinny and then he gets super skinny.
So, like, they didn't start from the south with like huge trains of, you know, grain and provisions coming with them. Like, he came up from beyond the wall, then he's at the wall, doesn't have a lot. Like, the northern lords are sort of just trying to get themselves through winter. I don't think they could afford to send him with too much more than he needed.
Yeah, and they do ration, right? Like, Aisha mentions it in one of the early days of the snow, that everyone just has like the last of Robert Glover's ale and just like a sausage, not a big one, and that's it, and bread. So I think they do kind of ration, but...
Do you think it was like a combination of bad planning and bad timing?
I really don't think we can blame
and
that
Stannis
on anyone, really.
I almost wonder, and this is, I'm going to blame the Not a Cast reread, because they have just entered Clash of Kings, and they're both huge Stannis fans, and they like talk a lot about Stannis' psychology, so it's rubbing off on me a little bit. But like, I wonder how much of this is like Stannis is like, it's impossible, and we're going to go anyway. So to a guy like that, it's not like... Like, he expects this, you know? He almost starved to death at Storm's End. Like, this is not... Of all the commanders in Westeros, he's probably one of the ones who's most accustomed to, or certainly of the remaining who are alive, to, like, physically suffering in this kind of way, and to seeing people, like, drop dead around you, and all your horses die, and, you know, so it happens to be snow in addition to hunger this time. I don't know that... You know, I feel like Stannis is both uniquely positioned to be the guy who experiences this and also like the worst person to do it, because he's not going to turn back.
I think like one lord was or knight or whatever was suggesting spending the winter at Deepwood Smut, and everyone else was like, well, what do you expect? There isn't enough food here to last us all winter. And in a way, both politically and... Like, because he has to keep moving on, I think he didn't really have a choice but to march on Winterfell. He needs to move. He cannot stay in Deepwood Mott. And if he goes elsewhere and regroup, it's also seen as a weakness, and all the northern clans will just leave him. So I'm not sure he really had a choice, and the snow really is bad timing.
Well, is any castle really well provisioned? I mean, they had a war through the spring.
Yeah, I think no one really
like,
is.
That was a bad idea.
White Harbor sure was, but other than that.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm curious, like, what would have happened if Stannis had been like, okay, I mean, I agree, Marie, about the Deepwood Mott thing, because that they do make it very clear that there is not enough at Deepwood Mott to keep them through the winter. But I like, what would have happened if they had been like, okay, we're making a forced march back to the wall? And, you know, maybe continue to send out scouting parties to kind of like carve a path down or something like that. But I don't know if that's possible. I don't study tactics, but, you know, like,
just
I feel
go
like
raid
another
the Riverlands
commander,
and then go to Winterfell.
Yeah, but I feel like
but
another
I mean,
commander
like,
would have been a little bit more, you know, I mean, they literally, like, the crazy thing is, like, this isn't the worst it gets. Like, Asha's next chapter is way worse. And,
yeah,
like,
but, like, look at the map. Deepwood Mott and Winterfell are not that far, and going anywhere else would actually be further on, and, like, they cannot go back at the wall. It's way, way up. up north, they don't have like ships or anything to carry them anywhere. It's crossing the Wolfswood, so it's not open ground, but it's still quite close in the north. Anywhere else, I don't really know where they could have gone.
Yeah, I agree.
So pretty much anything would have screwed them.
Yeah, I think if it snows this way, there going more north, further north to the wall wouldn't work, and there's basically nothing south. At least not close.
Yeah, at this point,
just look at the desperation that George puts into this chapter. Like, what's going on? I mean, like, horses are just falling over and they're, like, immediately being torn apart for the meat. You know, like, I think, was it a couple archers or something that, like, caught their tent on fire trying to stay warm? Like, it's that cold. Like, a dude, like, wanted to get a little closer to the fire and fought with someone else and, like, murdered him because, like, he needed the heat. Like, that's pretty extreme.
Yeah, but you read these descriptions of World War One and World War Two and the Napoleonic Wars, which I've done sadly with the majority of my life, and it rings so true. And this is what is amazing to me, right? So I'm saying that in the previous chapter, this very extreme behavior feels so true in the wake of hearing mm-hmm. about real life sex abuse. Now I'm saying that a lifetime of reading military history, and this rings so true. I mean, it's tremendous writing. And people do put themselves through this kind of craziness. That's what shocks me. War after war after war, people trudging through snow. 15 to 30 days is nothing when you read of what happened in Russia time and again in war after war. And it's just phenomenal to me. The other kind of slightly random thing this chapter reminded me of is when Asha is very perceptively saying that she thinks Stannis is the kind of man who just doesn't like any kind of woman. It's not just that he can't take her being a very masculine, militaristic woman. He can't cope with a feminine woman either. Stannis reminds me of a very certain type of English public schoolboy, by which I mean a guy who goes to a very expensive private school, which is all male boarding. And then they probably go to sort of an Oxford or Cambridge college, which is basically all male, and then into Whitehall or government, which is all male. And they've just never had to deal with women, and it just slightly scares them. again, that just seemed very true to life to me on a more minor note. I don't know, it sounds a bit offensive to the Brits, but he sounds very British to me, like of all the characters. He's the one that reads most English to me.
Oh, I can see that.
British.
Yeah, I think he's just very, like, you know, Chuck, that sort of like that English public schoolboy who just doesn't really know how to cope with women. Jacob Rees. He just reminds me of...
Stannis never misses a tea time.
He reminds me a lot of like a Jacob Rees-Mogg type character, just very austere and judgmental and like from 200 years ago. Oh dear, sorry.
I know that. It's also just like the people, the kind of guys who are just like, why are you here? And it's like, well, why are you here? You know, and I love that Asha has that kind of like, you know, she's used to it, but she's had it slightly easier than maybe somebody from the mainland, and that she's able to just be like, I'm not gonna get through to this guy.
I've seen this before. And also, if he had any kind of brains, I mean, this is a woman who's been to Winterfell before. She has been there in military circumstances. Wouldn't he want to not pick her brain or explicitly ask for advice, but surely she has information tactically, logistically, that he would find interesting. But he's not going to do that because she's a woman and she's just there as a trophy and to eat scraps from his table to make him feel like he has a bigger penis. I mean, it's just so pathetic.
I love Stannis. I'm a Manis fan. But he's always kind of struck me as, like, I don't know if you guys ever saw V for Vendetta, but they have, like, the propaganda guy who's in there, like, England prevails. Like, no matter what's going on, he's just like, yes, and England prevails. And, like, that just kind of is Stannis to me, like, it'll be fine. Like, you know, even if he doesn't necessarily add up, he's just like, mine by rights, on to Winterfell. Just keep marching. What's wrong with you? I'm marching.
Pray harder.
George, for Stannis' dialogue bothers a lot from people like Hitler and so forth, like one realm, one king, one god, one nation, one fuser, you know, like straight up quoting.
Yeah, there is something very eerie, sinister about the linguistic parallels there. I agree, Jock.
I think to get back to the horror of this chapter and the horses and the men dying, in a way, like, it's awful, it's terrible, but it's a very different terrible than the Theon chapter. Because there's still some dignity in them, even though they fight and they're not they don't agree, and you've got the Queensmen and stupid knights. But like, there's a mention when Asha thinks about her capture, she's like, she was blooded but blessedly unraped, and she's actually treated and protected quite well, which is like a small beacon of light in all of this, which is at least here. There's no sexual violence.
Yeah, I mean, like, all these three chapters have women horrifically abused and treated badly, and yet this one is comparatively the best.
Mm-hmm.
And as Asha says, at least I'm fed and clothed and,
yeah,
you know, for most of it, not walking foot by foot. So, yeah, that says it all. It really
It's a small all. Victory.
Indeed. To that, but then again, I mean, I think it's a beautifully written chapter. I think it's very different to the previous one. Like, there's not lots of plot and conspiracy to discuss. You just sit back and admire it. Although I think there's an interesting parallel that the linear reread throws up, which is both Asha and Cersei at one point say, well, sometimes you just need to submit to stay alive and fight another day. So I think there's the pragmatism of women, you know, sometimes just bend the knee and get on to the next thing.
Yeah, not all of them, because I started reading Fire and Blood lately, and I'm just at the point, just the conquest, you know, and Dawn unyielding because of this 90-something-year-old Princess of Dawn, who's just being like, nope, unbent, unbroken, whatever the words are. So yeah, not all women have that yeah, pragmatic sides to just yield at some point.
I was actually shocked to read that came from Balon Greyjoy. I was like, that might be the smartest, the only smart thing he has ever said. Like, no man ever died from bending his knee. Whoa.
Yeah, definitely.
True.
And I like, actually, that even though, like, the Iron Islands are terrible and Balon Greyjoy is terrible, but he did have some impact on his daughter, and there's, like, she learned from him, at least that, and she has respect for him and what he taught her, and that's, like, a good point for him.
Yeah, I think so, because we respect and admire Asha, so if she sees some value in him, it kind of... Yeah, Jock's kind of like laughingly put unbowed, unbent, unbroken in the chat.
Yeah, because I couldn't remember those three words.
But ironic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and as Adam says, didn't the Starks go south to bend the knee and got roasted? True.
No, they didn't, actually. No. They bent the knee and no one died.
Oh, you mean, he means...
No, I mean like Brandon and Rick are, weren't they, wasn't
yeah.
Mad King being like, come bend the knee, and they, you know, they showed up. I don't know if they actually bent the knee or...
That's another situation entirely. Like, there's the Mad King in it.
Yeah. It's not like the end of a war, or like giving up arms or anything. But
I don't think they were kneeling so much as they were like, let's try and work this out. And the Mad King was like, let's do it.
He was like, fire is the champion of House Targaryen.
Yeah.
Well, Balon bend the knee and then was able to rise again.
Mm-hmm. To rebuild his fleet, I'll just bend the knee again if it doesn't work out, bro. It's cool.
Oh, dear. Anyway, does
in
anyone
her
have
head, that's how it happened.
Does anyone else have anything that actually happens in this chapter?
Oh, just that when she started talking about her mom, I just feel so bad for, like, everybody basically involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad. Their lives are sad.
Yeah.
Theon's life is sad, you know? Just sad family.
These are sad chapters.
Yeah, there's a little tidbit. Like, I'm a horse rider myself, and so, you know, when we take the horse like to a competition or something, they go in a truck for horses, whatever you call that, and we put protective stuff on their legs so that they don't injure themselves. And when you do that for the first time, they are really, really, like, weirded out by having these on their legs, and they walk really weirdly. So that made me think of when they put the snow things and they refuse to walk with them.
Aww.
So George is well informed.
There's also the really sad bit where one of them breaks his ankle because he's just so freaking out about it. And you get the feeling that George does have these good technical people he can ask, because just even the way he describes the different type of horse and how much they would eat, and the different way in which they walk and act, it's so good.
definitely.
It's also, you know, this just occurred to me, but like, you know, we're inclined to sympathize with the Northmen and, you know, the Norries and the Littles and whatever. And they're all, you know, oh, the Ned's girl, we have to go get the Ned's girl, which great, all for that. But like, you know, and then they're laughing at the Southerners for like shivering and not having horses prepared for the cold. And it's like, maybe fill them in before you leave or something, you know, like there could have been like there's kind of no top down assessment of who knows what and who knows how to deal with what situation, how, and to kind of like combine that information. So like that actually kind of like makes me annoyed and sad because, you know, we keep going through how like the Northmen don't lose any men. And it's like, well, that's great. Like, good for you guys. But like, share some of the information, share some of the wealth. Like, you know, yeah, you are one army.
I agree. But that's the point about, you know, these armies in history, these composite armies. They're not one army and they don't necessarily feel loyalty to each other. They all follow the leader for varying reasons, but there's often not much camaraderie between the different constituent groups. Mm-hmm. Anything else on this chapter?
Just that every time I look at these chapters, I always, because I've read that pink letter, like the spoiler chapter, so many times, and I kind of just feel like all of this stuff happens in the Winds of Winter spoiler chapters, and I kind of forget that, like, oh yeah, some of this was in Dance.
Indeed. Actually, Dance, I mean, like, this is what made me, I mean, like, my impression of Dance relative to what Dance actually is really changing with this reread. And yes, a lot of the Dany stuff is still tedious, but there's so much good stuff in here, and it just, I'm really reassessing it as we go.
Yeah, everything having to do with the North is amazing, and these chapters made me realize how close we are to the end of Dance, actually, like, in terms of what's happening and where the story is at the moment for us, waiting for the next book. That's basically almost it, like a few more chapters and we're there. We're there with Stannis. So
yeah, I mean, we're 10 reread episodes off the end of our reread, and that includes episodes that are entirely TWOW.
Yeah,
there's not much Dance left, and the Cersei chapter in particular is very close to the end.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of, that's exciting. But what I love about this is the writing in these three chapters is as good as anything in vintage Storm of Swords. And that makes me so hopeful for George, and if and when we get another book, that he's still capable of writing this stuff. It's very hopeful to me. Okay, well, on that happy note, anything else on this one?
Not on the content of a chapter, but I only noticed this from the chapter titles because I'm an idiot. But in all of her chapter titles, she's described as being defined by other people, as in the Clarkin's daughter, the Wayward Light, and the King's Flies. Was wondering if that would clue into Asha's arc in the coming books.
That's a really good point, and I never realized that, so you're certainly not an idiot. And maybe it's a point about how women are defined by their relation to men, or maybe it's something specific about her and that she'll come into her own at some point. But
yeah, I don't know.
Feel like I was going through the book trying to find the chapters, sorry Hannah, and
no, it's okay.
Many chapters, like most of them except for John, Danny, Jamie, and Cersei are not actually the names of the characters. Like, there are a lot of them with this kind of the King's Prize, the Ghost of Winterfell, and the Ugly Little Girl, and all of them. And I'm not sure I really appreciate what George is doing there. Like, I'm not sure I really.
Oh, I've been trying to figure this out since Feast came out. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I think he said, like, oh, it'll all make sense, or, oh, there's a reason, and you can figure it out, and I'm like, okay, but, I mean, some of them it makes sense. Like, Theon, I think it makes sense, because his identity is shifting so much.
Absolutely.
So, like, most and other people, it's like, just say Asha.
Yeah,
like,
for sure. Exactly.
You're like, the Captain of the Guards, the Griffin Reborn, what is, I feel like he's gonna, like, Wins is gonna come out, and he's like, oh, yeah, I stopped doing that, that was a pain, and I've numbered the chapters, so it's easier. All right, guys.
But mic, I mean, drop. Like, it makes sense for Theon because of his whole progression. It makes sense for Arya because she's like going through all of these different little characters in her story. But for the others, this is just, and it also makes sense for Sansa actually. But Asha just
hers doesn't change. It's just a link. It's like, okay.
Yeah. Fine. Yeah. Fine. Exactly. But just Asha. Name her Asha. I mean, we know who she is. It's just. There's, it's this kind of tiny, tiny bit of, oh, who is this chapter with at the beginning of a chapter, and two lines later, you know, and it doesn't really interest me.
Yeah, I very much agree. It's something that, I mean, you know, we all talk about, like, no spoilers for the chapter, but, like, the Forsaken chapter that has been read from Wins, and, like, that's another character who also, you know, has changing names. And it, at a certain point, like, yes, there is artistry to it. Like, I'm not going to say that it doesn't ever contribute something to the, you know, the feel of the chapter. Like, you can connect, you know, the King's Prize or whatever to some of what Ash is experiencing here. But, like, it's so inconsistent that it, like, drives me crazy, because we went through, like, 3.5 books without this, and then all of a sudden we're playing guessing games of mostly of characters who are very difficult to parse to begin with. So I'm not a fan, and if George wants to prove me wrong, then he is welcome to publish the following books.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Sorry, Hannah, did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Oh, just something ridiculous. I was just going to say about Asha's name changes. Like, those bastards at HBO couldn't give her her real name either. Got half of us saying our halftime sounding like idiots. I do
well,
that all
Asha
the
turned out to be goes, such an important no, character Asha. In the series.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. Worth it. And also, I mean, come on. But anyway. Not to get into a, I hate you, D&D.
Yeah, but yeah, we hear Please you, don't. We feel you, we agree with you.
I would feel very left out in that conversation.
Also true.
Emmy-winning David and Dan.
Oh, fuck off. Just fuck right off.
That
right.
Started.
Okay, well, let's avoid the negativity and move swiftly forward. So after Asha 2, we jump forward a massive 23 chapters to Cersei 2. It takes place 3 days later on June the 19th, and I believe it's the lovely Queen James with the chapter summary.
All right. It is the evening before Cersei's Walk of Atonement. Her anxiety is all-consuming, and she is pacing her cell like a lion beneath Casterly Rock. Cersei knows that this is her only only chance at escaping the Sept. Unlike Margaery, Cersei has little friends in the faith. She understands that a trial by combat is her best bet during her trial, which will take place a couple days later. On the morning of her walk, Cersei is stripped and shaven by the Silent Sisters and led to a courtyard, escorted by the Warrior Sons. She sees Lancel and the Warrior Sons, and that pisses her off. She is standing near the spot where she saw Eddard's head get stricken off, and she thinks back to the day on how Joffrey fucked everything up. It's all his fault. If it weren't for Joffrey, Eddard would still be alive, and everything in the kingdom would be perfect. Cersei's sins are then announced to the gathering crowd, and she is forced to make a walk from the Sept of Baelor to the Red Keep. Throughout her walk, she is pelted with shit and screamed at. And pretty much, I mean, the walk is pretty terrible. There's a lot of detail to the walk we can get into later. I don't think a lot of that matters. But pretty much when she gets to the Red Keep, she sees Kevin. He pretty much tells her to go put something on and gets her inside the castle, where she sees Sir Robert the Strong. And I mean, that's pretty much it. She gets swept up in the arms of Sir Robert the Strong and taken inside the Red Keep. The end.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is, right?
The chapter overall, I think I read this chapter so many times in the past, and I never really thought it was as bad as what it was until I actually heard it in the audiobook. And I just don't know if listening to the account rather than reading it is just what made it so bad, or maybe, I don't know, the way I perceive things have changed since the last time I read this. But this time it was, like, horrifying. And I mean, she's just getting, like, pelted with shit, and guys are, you know, like, flashing her and talking about her body and just all these terrible things.
Yeah, it's just horrific. And I don't know, like Mary, I read the first of the Cersei chapters as well. And maybe it's just because I've read The Testaments by Margaret Atwood, but the Sept has really reminded me of the aunts. And, you know, it's bad enough that the Sept, the High Septon is just, and all these men are exploiting her, but the way the women are treating her, and, you know, they're walking the streets shouting shame, shame, shame. It's so Handmaid's Tale.
Mm.
It's freaking me the fuck out. And
I think she has a good point. Like, when she hears the first whore, and that's a woman saying it, she thinks to herself, women are often worse than men in beating up other women. And I find that quite true, actually, in our world too. I mean, we can be our own enemies sometimes. I mean, women can be enemies to other women. It's not always solidarity.
Yeah,
I agree. Mean, if you want to go back to the you know, what we were discussing at the beginning of the episode in terms of like making your brainwashed, the people you torment, agents of their own kind of torment, I think you could apply that here, you know, very much so. And I think that's a big theme that Atwood is talking about in The Handmaid's Tale. I haven't read The Testaments, but...
Yeah, and well, right. In The Testaments, it's very clearly there because you get behind the scenes of Aunt Lydia. And without
Her follow-up?
Yes, and without spoiling it, you know, Aunt Lydia being the main, one of the protagonists or antagonists in the first book. And again, it's a bit like, you know, you learn a bit like, do you bend the knee in order to survive? And that's really her story. So yeah, there's definitely an element of that. But it is, it's a horrific chapter, and the fact that you see this woman who wants to be a lioness being psychologically broken effectively by the memories of her own past misdeeds and then being scooped up by Sir Robert Strong at the end, I think is, you know, and just utterly abandoned. Kevin Lannister, our house will not participate in your shame or be tainted by it. And yet her loyalty to her house is what she's using to get through. I am a lioness, I will not bend. I mean, she's, right. You know, she has a love and a respect for the house and being Tywin Lannister's daughter that the house does not show in any way to her. I found that really profoundly moving.
Well, Tywin would have marched troops in there.
Tywin would not have taken this.
He would not
ship.
Put up with this.
And, you know, that whole relationship with Kevin, as we will later see unfold, is very interesting. But I guess the main question or a conversation I was having with Vali, who really wanted to be on this episode but couldn't because he had to go to a one-year-old's birthday party. And as he put it, the one-year-old's not going to fucking know if I'm there. So he wasn't happy about
it. I told him to just send his kid. She's like a couple months old by now. She could do it by herself.
Just exactly. Send a cardboard cutout of yourself.
Doesn't represent.
Have his wife, like, prop it up.
Come on.
But, you.
Drop the kid ready off. To pick her up later.
He asked the question about what this does to Cersei. Does it break her, or does she see Sir Robert Strong and think, right, fucking vengeance on all of you? Because I got the feeling that when she was scooped up by him, that was a kind of like, yes, now I have a hero who can avenge me.
Yeah.
But the epilogue obviously suggests maybe she's withdrawn and taking baths the whole time. And like, what's your theory? Do you think Cersei is broken, or do you think she will rise again?
I'll say this. Let's not forget, she's guilty of all these things and more. So I think she's already broken.
But I don't think she thinks she's guilty of these things. You know what I mean? Like, she doesn't view it the way anyone else does. I think she's shook because this was something she couldn't get out of. This is something she couldn't find her way around. But I think that translates into pissed, and that translates into vengeance. And, you know, I don't know, Robert Strong probably has something to do with that, maybe. We'll see. I think this translates into murder of the faith.
I feel like, I mean, first of all, this chapter is so powerful, and actually reading it without having like been involved in the reread. And I think if you read this as part of Cersei's overall journey, it's very different. But I was reading it, and I even remember the first time I read this, and I was like, yes, go girl, you hold your head up, you go, you do that. And I was just like, I hate Cersei. Like, what's going on? You know, this is ridiculous and unfamiliar and strange to me. But I think she's a fundamentally, like, I think this is, I think it breaks her, but not in the way that like would be helpful, you know, to Kevin, actually, if he were allowed to continue living. I think that this is the type of thing that, you know, like, you know, when you hit your television, or back in the old days when you used to have a television that would, you know, have a radial dial on it and stuff like that, you would hit it to try and get it to keep working. And, you know, so, sometimes that worked, and other times it just broke the thing entirely, and it would start going crazy on you. So I think Cersei has been pushed past any empathy that she might have had, any reason that she might have had. Like, this is that what George does, I think, so horrifically well in giving people the fate that you want them to have and then forcing you to exist with those consequences. I don't think that Cersei, I think Cersei's broken from any chance she could have had of anything good or recovery or whatever, but I don't think she's going to see it that way.
Yeah, I think, like, to answer your question, Mina, she's both broken and gonna rise in a vengeful way. Like, she's not gonna stay out and be just with herself the whole time. She's broken, and she's going to make everyone pay for that.
Yeah, I think you're probably all right.
Yeah, I guess, do we look at it as like two different aspects? Like when a person has a traumatic experience that breaks them down, we look at, I don't want to like be like good and evil, but like a positive character who's maybe like, you know, more self-aware, trying to do good things. They're broken down, they're traumatized, like they need help to get over that. Someone who is like, you know, that we view as like the bad character, like when they get broken, we think, well, maybe it will spur them to realizing their bad deeds because they're being punished for something they've done. And I don't think she fits into either of those categories here.
Hmm. Yeah, I see that. Another question I had, or actually Matt had, is do we believe Cersei's counterfactual history? In other words, do we believe that, as she posits, that if Joffrey hadn't had Ned killed and that they'd sent him to the wall, that they could have done a deal with the Starks, Rob would have bent the knee, she would have married Sansa off maybe to Lancel, and there wouldn't have been a war. Do we believe her counterfactual history?
No. I do not.
Well, she was intent on sending him to the wall, though, right? I mean, that was definitely the plan.
Yeah, but I don't think that it would have worked out the way that she thinks that it would have, that the North would have
like everything would be fine.
The North wouldn't actually have been the problem. I think she just doesn't account for Varys and Littlefinger trying
exactly.
to get chaos into all of this. And I think actually she might be right. The North would have wanted to protect Sansa, who would have been a hostage, and Ned did agree to go to the wall, and he would have told Rob to just be on the sidelines for now.
I think Rob doesn't go to war, but I also don't know if Ned actually goes to the wall. He says, yeah, I'll go to the wall, he gets halfway up there and says, you know what, like, you know, he has his honor and all that, but
I think he would go. But
I think you know Ned, right?
I know that. I know. I understand it's what got him killed. But I think he also realized what's going on is too important. He has a duty to Robert. He has a duty to his friends. Like, this is a way he gets out of it and realizes that he can come back. I mean,
I agree with.
I think this whole experience is the one thing that would maybe change him. You know, because his honor got him so screwed. And again, he's honor bound to Lyanna and honor bound to Robert over like, oh yeah, Cersei, I'll go to the wall. Like, I mean, I understand like he can't tell a lie, but at some point, you know, you just got to do what's right.
Yeah, but in the meantime, Sansa is still in King's Landing, and she will be killed if he does anything. So
I don't think that he's necessarily rising in rebellion or anything right away, but I don't think he's necessarily just going to the wall never to be heard of from again.
But is his own life worth it in that case? Like, I mean, he hasn't sworn to the wall, but like, or to the watch, but you know, it's taken very seriously when you say you're going to the wall and then you don't. Like, it's not just Ned being Ned.
Well, but once he's in the North, though, like, you know, he's being sent up unjustly as everyone in the North views it. I don't think anyone has a problem if he just makes a beeline to Winterfell and they say fuck that shit, you know. And Maybe he says we're no longer a part of the Seven Kingdoms, and it's some sort of, you know, thing where he tries to get Sansa back for years, or I don't know.
And Sansa
dies. I love you. I mean, you're a great person. You're completely writing like fan fiction here. I just don't see Ned doing that.
I just don't see him going to the wall and just like going out of the story. I mean, that's probably
sure.
Why
maybe he
probably
would.
Why
maybe he
him
would
off
be
there.
Involved from the wall, but there's no doubt in my mind that he would like be at the wall. It's possible that he would still. You know, if Kat got back to Winterfell and they were maybe able to communicate more easily, it's possible that he would
he's duty bound to fix what's going on.
Why
was he gave his oath to Robert? He is supposed to be the regent, like all of that.
But
like Cersei doesn't have authority to send him to the wall in his mind. You know what I mean? It's because he's holding the daughters. If she didn't have Sansa, he would be like fuck you.
Yeah, but he decides to go to the wall because she does have Sansa, and then that holds up until he gets there. I mean, I don't see how he could change his mind and be like, well, actually, what convinced me before doesn't work now.
Right,
and also,
I don't know. He decides
to go to the
Sansa.
Wall over being killed. Like, he was like, you know, he was like, it's fine if it's my, you know, neck on the line, I don't care. And then Varys is like, oh, actually, it's going to be your daughter's.
Right, that's the thing that he was worried about.
I like your fan fiction. It's exciting, and it is way less depressing than the real story.
But I feel like if anything's going to change Ned's, you know, kind of stupid honor at some point, it's going to be an event like that. I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
I just think there's only so much you can do to push someone.
Here's another counterfactual. What would have happened if Peter had been allowed to marry Sansa?
Excuse me.
Because that really changes the plot with Lysa. Oh, and it massively changes what happens in the East, right?
Does Lysa stay quiet at that point, or does she just get pissed?
Yeah. Oh, she gets pissed.
I mean, he has to kill her at some point anyway, but...
I think at this point, she gets pissed. She confesses to the murder of Jon Arryn, and that's it.
So assume that maybe he kills her at the wedding, or he kills her before the wedding, and then he marries Sansa. But he doesn't have the Knights of the Vale, and he doesn't have anything in the Vale of Arryn. But he has Winterfell, I guess? I don't know.
Or Harrenhal? Or no, he gets Harrenhal later.
I mean, it's tough with Littlefinger because, at least the way I conceive of the guy, his top line goal is getting to marry Sansa. It used to be getting to marry Catelyn again, but now it's Sansa. So it's interesting to me, and like everything he does is like, yes for power, yes for instability, yes for all that stuff. But I firmly believe that that's ultimately, and he may not even be aware of this, but I think it's secondary to his lust for this child. So I wonder what his actions would have been like if that desire had been satisfied, you know, because he's still working on it, and you know, in the Vale, like she's in his clutches, but he still doesn't quite have what he wants because they're not together and she hasn't like capitulated willingly to him and all that. So I don't know. I don't know. But Lysa, it actually would have been really nice to see Lysa be a variable that he couldn't account for. That would have been very satisfying. Alas.
Yes, indeed. That was my final note on this chapter. I don't know if anyone has anything else.
I do.
Go for it.
I had a note, it's the only note. She starts to get a little hysterical at one point, and she has this interesting bit of internal monologue where she says one thing that's rooted in reality, and then like the combined sentences then fantasy. She says Jamie would have slashed through the crowds, which is probably true if he were there, and then here's the fantasy part, cutting out the eyes of every man that dared look upon her. And that to me is like her entire everything about her is that,
and which is left probably, hand no less.
Yeah, and this chapter is like the epitome of all of that.
I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this to defend Cersei, because obviously she has a serious degree of delusion and you know, a lot of what she thinks even before in this chapter is not rational. And like she even has a line about how like Kevin was involved in this, which is true, but then how Margaery was involved in this, which is, at least to me, seems unlikely, at least directly.
Margaery's involved in everything.
Yeah, right. Right.
That's Tyrion.
Paranoid of Cersei, right? But I mean, it makes sense to me that in such a traumatic situation, you would start to have visions of safety and vengeance and, you know, somebody and like a magical thing happening to save you from it. Like that doesn't seem crazy.
Her shining brother lover knight.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's normal. I'm just saying. Something that I thought though was, and this is just because I think I've been like a little bit obsessed with Tudor history recently. But when Cersei's on the steps of Baelor and reflecting about how like the crowd is looking at her, like the crowd was looking at Ned Stark, and it kept, you know, like Tudor history was just such a crazy cycle of like you would be the person watching the execution of the person you just toppled over, and then like 2 years later you would be the person on the scaffold about to be executed. And that cycle just like I do think there is a lot of Tudor influence on what George is doing with the King's Landing plotline. And I think that like that just stood out really vividly to me, that it is this ultimately cyclical experience. And, you know, I'm sure that Cersei will have the streets running with the blood of peasants and poor fellows and sparrows and all those people, like and Septas especially. But, you know, it does just keep going, and it's really unnerving, and kind of the people just sort of witness it at the same time, and it's like nothing changes. It's just every, you know, the people involved change and they cycle through, but everybody else just kind of stays the same and witnesses the butchery.
Yeah.
Do you think that like the, obviously I think definitely the Septas who were involved, if Cersei gets any amount of power back, are kind of fucked. But do you think that certain people that she was kind of pointing out during her walk, like different peasants and things like that, like do you think she's just going to have gold cloaks and Kingsguard just like butchering people in the street over this?
If she's in a position to, yeah, I would think so.
I agree.
I mean, I think it's worse. Like, I don't think she's going to be able to be like, find that person specifically. I think it's going to be like, that person fits into a category. In other words, peasant women or peasant children or peasant men, and like, kill them all. Yeah. Again, if she has the opportunity, she might not.
I could conceive her like, or conceive of her contriving to like have, you know, a wedding for Tommen and then invite and like, let's invite the small folk, and then having her sit there and like then recognizing people and actually saying, yeah, like follow that person out, you know, that yeah. person over there. That's something I could see her doing. Her
is this King's Landing a city of like 500,000 people though? I mean, I don't know.
But do you know what I mean? I could see her. I could definitely see her fantasizing about it and yeah. and fixating on a fantasy like that.
Right, I mean, I could see her going, yes. going to the market and seeing someone and being like, that's a guy, you know, just having someone executed yeah. and maybe it's not even anyone well, that was you actually.
Know, Cersei doesn't go. The streets.
Market,
though.
But theory is actionable.
Well, right. I mean, I don't know if he was ever out in the city for something. But yeah, I feel like it's all about how much power she's going to have within the city, and it's not well defined, is it? Like how many men the Faith have, like armed men. Certainly, like the City Watch and the Lannister Guard is would be more than enough. But the issue is, of course, the commoners. If yes, you know do something in the streets and everyone just rises up against you, you're fucked.
I think the Faith has quite a lot of men, actually. Because when Kevin comes to see her in a previous chapter, I mean, maybe he's just lying and. But he says he didn't arrive first in King's Landing, and that he anyway didn't have enough men to like break her free, because he didn't have time to raise another army.
But I mean, do you think they have like 1,000 men, or do you? I mean, I don't know. I figured they've got, you know, hundreds of people that have joined the Faith militant, and I guess part of it is the show. Because in my head, like I envision that they've got this sackcloth and like clubs, and I'm like, they don't look intimidating at all.
You know, what I mean? Like, I have no idea, really. But I think
remember, Mary hadn't watched the show, Adam.
It's fine.
Well, no, I know, but like it's just the way they're dressed is all I'm saying.
Thanks, Dina.
Yeah. Reading about them in the book, they're a lot more intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, they have former knights and stuff too, right?
Right, and armor and shields yeah. and swords and yeah, they're just.
But plus, I mean, and even it wouldn't matter how many men you had, I would think, if they have her basically as a hostage, and you're like, well, we're going to storm them with 1,000 men. It's like, well, they, you know, what's the guarantee they're not going to kill her before you get down yeah. there?
Also, always think of the Faith militant as being like the Templar knights. I mean, these were aristocratic, rich knights, fully suited and booted with the latest in military tech. So I think, you know, George is basing this more off history, and that they would be a
slave. I think that's where they want to go. I just feel like how long have they been established here in the book? 3 months, 4 months? Like, how long has it been? So, like, they haven't had a ton of time to get together and organize and train and all that.
But Adam, they have 7 gods on their side.
Yeah, and don't mention the stranger.
Yeah, I just think, I don't know. I think if Cersei has a way to take out a bunch of peasants, she's going to, if she has the possibility. And, of course, the entire Faith, I think, just give it time.
Yeah, so, I'm curious if, like, the whole trial is actually going to happen at all, or is it all going to go down with the trial? Because, like, no one's beating undead Gregor, and then she just murders everyone else there? Or, like, well, I mean, I wonder what her plan is.
I'm not sure she has an actual plan at the end of this.
Right.
She just, yeah. But actually, well, like, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we have to remember, like, everything that's happening near King's Landing right now at the same time anyways, with Fagon Landing and taking Storm's End and, you know, all that's
yeah,
happening
that's true.
Right at the same time as this, that even if I think it said her trial is in 5 days, a lot of shit can happen in 5 days. You know, they can get wind that there's an army marching on King's Landing. I don't think they're going to bother with a trial if they have to
get wind at all.
Yeah. And even in the epilogue, dog, she has no power, right? Like, we know that, you know, Kevin is killed, and then it's most likely she's going to assume power very quickly. But, you know, her currently all she has is, you know, a knight that will, you know, go in armed combat and protect her. Maybe once she has access to troops, she does something stupid.
I do wish that we got one more POV from her after this chapter, because this is her last POV, and I just... With the way that Kevin kind of perceives her after this as kind of being broken, and she doesn't seem herself, and she prays, and, you know, she's doing all this things that are not typical Cersei behavior. I almost wonder the first
it's a
way
show for him.
Right. But yeah, that's exactly the way I read it initially was, oh, you know, this is just her way of kind of putting on an act, you know, to make everybody think that she's this broken person when really she's just plotting revenge the entire time. And so that's why I want one more chapter. I just wish it, we can get in her head one more time after this to find out what's going on.
Yeah. I think the yes, oh yes, in italics at the end of this chapter just confirms that she's not gonna spend the rest of her life praying and on the sidelines.
I mean, yeah, even her actions in this chapter, like, you know, she has, you know, that monologue going on when she's like, yes, Septa, and like, she has definitely very contrary thoughts to what she's saying, so...
Yeah, and
I
find her state of mind at the beginning of this really interesting, and you can see how just terrible is the faith when they dress her with a robe so that she can cross the Sept without everyone having to see naked flesh, but then she has to go naked through the whole city. She thinks to herself, Sevens, what hypocrites they are, and that's very true. So I think all of this is building up her hatred and everything against the faith, and she's not gonna just go praying after that.
Well, yeah, I mean, also I think we have to keep in mind that, like, the reason why Kevin is assassinated by Varys is so that she will take control and she will, you know, as basically ASAP cause maximum chaos and damage and stuff.
Kevin is too competent.
Yeah, exactly. And the point is that, like, oh, great. So we have when Aegon comes, doesn't matter how he comes or what he looks like or whatever. The people of King's Landing are just going to be like, yes, anyone else. And yeah, I think at least to some degree we have to expect that to happen. Obviously, there's so many variables and it's kind of like mind-boggling. But actually, you know, James, I find it funny though, just to go back to what you're saying about, like, you know, you want another Cersei chapter? Like, so you can't wait 10 years for a Cersei chapter? Like, come on, like, what's the big deal?
She's your favorite character.
I can't.
You're really not a patient man. I mean, come on, it's just 10 years.
Oh my God, it feels like 11.
I feel like it's going to get worse for her.
Yet, right?
I think
2011 was when this came out, right?
Oh no,
yeah, it came out in 2011.
Yeah,
8 years.
That's reassuring. It's only it's only 8 years.
We haven't hit a decade yet.
Yeah.
No, we're gonna get it by Con of Thrones next year. For
yeah,
sure.
Right.
Okay, before we
Written
get into the whole melancholy of I want wins, please, I want wins, and hatred at George, I actually have another point on all of these chapters.
Good. rescue us, Mary. Bring us back to textual analysis.
I think we got quite a lot of memories of the first book and Winterfell and the Stark children in these three chapters. Like, it's basically all Theon thinks about his childhood there and the fights with, the training with Rob and Jon. And even Cersei spends a good moment thinking about Ned and how that all went down. And, like, it's not really literary or anything, but it made me melancholic and sad, like, thinking about the first book and how perfect Winterfell was and the home it was to the Stark children. It's all gone.
Yeah, I'm listening to the audiobooks. I'm about halfway through Game of Thrones right now. And it's been a while since I've actually went back and read chapter for chapter of that book. And it's really, really sad going back and seeing, you know, the last time that Catelyn leaves Bran, or, you know, all that is just kind of depressing. Or right now, the last chapter that I listened to was when Ned was attacked in the street and broke his leg. And, you know, Jaime had Jory Cursell killed. It's just like, oh, no, I forgot about Jory, and now I like him so much again.
Yeah. And he's nothing wrong.
No, he should have left. He broke through the line and he should have just left, but he had to come back. He's so honorable.
And you know, like in Theon chapter, you've got he talks about Winterfell and how it's broken now, and the panels of the Winter Garden, the glass garden, and it seems like the perfect town, and it seems like it was actually like really civilized and peaceful, and sad.
Yeah, Starks are the best of them for sure.
I mean, it is fascinating how, like, I think each of these chapters represents a different kind of, like, decay and, you know, the rules for the reader and for the POV are not that they haven't broken down before, but they continue to break down and really, you know, I mean, Winterfell is so rotten, like, it's like in pieces in Theon's chapter. And, you know, we're not, like, we really haven't seen that in a very long time. And then, you know, for Asha, like, the idea of a military march with, you know, hundreds of thousands of men, and this should theoretically, you know, work out pretty well, and it's fine. And, you know, like, it like, everybody has confidence that it can be done, even if it's going to be difficult. And then, you know, here, obviously, Cersei has her entire self-image, like, ripped apart and trampled and, you know, shat upon. So it's, yeah, I don't know. I do love rereads like this because it is fascinating to see how, and I'm sure other chapters in between and toward the end of the book are going to be similarly kind of, you know, in pieces and representative of things falling apart. But I just love, I mean, I hate it, but I also love it that George really invests in that idea. And like, he's not here to make this easy for us. And like, there are so many things that I remember talking about when Dance first came out. Like, I remember like a very long thread on Westeros.org about whether or not the Walk of Shame was sexist in terms of the way it was written. And I feel like we don't talk about that kind of thing too much anymore, maybe because we're just so used to the plot point. But whether or not like you want to read it that way, I think the part of the point is that, you know, devolution and that increasing, you know, it was kind of like relegated to the Riverlands for a long time, you know, where that like festering sore of the war was really focused. And now it's everywhere. Make any sense?
I think I completely agree, right? This brokenness that is physical in Winterfell is moral and complete in King's Landing too. The war is everywhere. The snow may only be in the north, but this complete societal breakdown, I think you're completely right. And we are at the trough of it, the nadir, as we approach the end of Dance, and it's only going to get grimmer.
I have a question. Do we know, we don't know a ton about how George writes. I know that he will tend to tackle like a character for a chunk. I mean, he didn't write the books, the chapters in the order that the book is published, obviously. But what I found with linear format is that we often get these little groupings of these chapters that thematically line up. They really go well together. And I mean, like last week even, or last, you know, reread, like the kind of just all these travel log kind of boring nothing chapters too. It's like, were those all kind of written together, maybe? Like, some of the stuff happens at the same time, but I don't really know, like, where he's writing it or what his state of mind is. But it seems like maybe some of these chapters that are kind of spread out across the book, maybe were done in the same kind of state of mind for his writing.
Like, he was on a really good streak and just banged out right. really strong, iconic
and like,
chapters.
This theme goes through five or six chapters that are all actually chronologically very close together, and you're like, oh, that's weird, you know? Cool.
Yeah, I think that's probably very valid. We'll never know, though, right? Or we might, I suppose. He might reveal.
Well, we will once he writes his, you know, epic retelling of the telling of A Song of Ice and Fire.
Dream of Spring will have his documentary that he's been working on in secret with all the behind-the-scenes details on a DVD.
I just can't even.
So with Winterfell and Theon, it's interesting because, you know, he's broken and missing pieces and it's like mirrored in the decay of the castle. And then Asha's in a situation where she's a commander on a march with an army, but she's not in command. So there's that frustration. I had a kind of mental note about the writing here, though. With Theon, it is interesting because it brings up, like, in a society like this, what really sick people could get away with if they were highborn enough behind closed doors. And I think there was a little bit of that in the last reread, too. Well, in all, kind of, I guess, all the chapters. And then, like, Cersei, that kind of thing did happen in real world history. They would do that kind of thing. You got to crawl on your knees and stuff. And it's just interesting how those are facets of history we don't romanticize a lot. So then when George holds them up to us, it's really hard to look at and remember that this is real. Like, some of the people that we make heroes in our history are not great people and did these kinds of things.
Indeed. Just like Wyman Manderly is not as nice as we thought he was.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a very thoughtful and profound point. Any others, or shall we wrap up the podcast today?
Robert Strong still kind of cracks me up. He's taken a vow of silence. Like, you can hear Qyburn being like, he's taken a vow of silence. His name is Robert Strong.
Wink, wink.
Yeah,
he also refuses to show his face.
He can love.
Yeah, it's very silly. But we
I
need
to say one thing I want when Winds comes out is I want that someone to swear on a peacock or a pheasant, because apparently that was a thing in medieval history. you would go to your lord, like, to sign a contract basically, and they would bring a peacock and you would, like, swear by the peacock. And I'm like, I don't know how we don't know this, but it needs to be in these books.
I agree. Make it happen, George, because of course you listen to this podcast.
Definitely.
This is his favorite. This is his favorite of the rereads. He's
of course. I'm
pretty sure he told
so
Greg
much,
that,
and
right?
And we say it so much, and we're like, take all your time, so you must love us.
Yeah.
Honestly, like, if any of you had George fatigue or George melancholy, just read these three chapters. They will reignite your love for Dance and for George.
Yeah, but it's always the same thing. Like, these kind of chapters, they reignite my love for George, but they also reignite my, oh my God, I need Wins, please. So it goes both ways.
I agree. Okay, well, on that somewhat ambiguous note, let's wrap up this episode of just tremendous chapters, and really it was so much fun discussing them with all of you. For those of you listening at home, I think the next episode is going to be hosted by Mary. Still up for that?
Yep.
Mary.
Yep,
and
sure.
It's going to cover Theon Flive the Turncloak, where he gets more brought into the plans of Barbary Dustin. We get Dany Seven, where she's turning down the marriage offer from Quentin, and Arya Two, the ugly little girl from Dance, which is actually the last Arya chapter published in Feast Dance, so a bit of a, you can tell we're coming slowly towards the end. Yeah, I know, it's like the final Arya chapter in Dance, so that's going to be pretty epic. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress, etc. by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave or VOK Podcast and get involved. It feels like it's been a bit quiet lately. Does anyone have any forthcoming episodes that they're recording that they want to pimp out here?
We will definitely do Downton Abbey podcast.
Yeah,
I think
I really want to see that.
Did you see it yet?
No.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
is it good?
It's awesome. It's awesome.
My wife is laughing at me.
Said it was amazing.
I'm gonna go and have to see that on my own.
It's great. I saw it with a great friend of mine, and we are both great fans, and we were just going, the two of us, in a spiral of, oh God, how marvelous, the whole time. So it was fun.
It takes place like after the series, right?
Very long after. Yeah.
Cool.
I think there's a VOK about the Joker coming up as well. Hotly anticipated movie.
Yeah, Thomas is trying to put that together, I think.
I'm looking forward to listening to that.
Yeah, Philip and I were
not watching the movie.
But... yeah, but to name drop a little bit, or city drop, Philip and I were at the Venice Film Festival closing night awards ceremony, and it's a very sort of art house independent movie festival, but people often launch there if they want to win Oscars. And the Joker won the best film, and you could just hear audible gasps from the audience, because the kind of films that win that are the art house ones, the kind of, you know, and went to have a main American films never win, and to have a mainstream like comic book movie win, it was just. And as we were walking into the award ceremony, sadly we weren't there because it was playing earlier in the week, so we weren't there for the Joker or for Ad Astra. We were there for Waiting for the Barbarians with Johnny Depp and Mark Rylance, and
I liked Ad Astra
and another award-winning film that was European. But so we were walking out the red carpet like to go in, and there's there was Joaquin Phoenix and the director were there, and we were like, are they gonna win? Because there's no way these stars would turn up to the awards show if they weren't gonna win. And they were like, okay, context, so maybe they're gonna win, so maybe Joaquin Phoenix is gonna win best actor, and then some like random Italian actor no one's ever heard of outside of Italy won best actor, and we're like, shit, is this gonna win like best film?
So, for the whole festival.
I mean, that was major. So everyone was like talking. So basically, the film that won the second best film was a Roman Polanski film, and the Joker won the top film. And I think the Joker, that was almost
odd.
I know, it was like very controversial. So I'm really excited to see it.
But I think it's supposed to be like a little more like, you know, like art housey. But
it looks
I'm
like
not
Taxi
sure,
Driver,
like,
doesn't it? Them.
Yeah. Someone told me it was. What is that? I can't think of the name. Like, they basically borrowed the plot from an old movie. Comedian.
King of Comedy.
Yes. Sorry, I'm looking. Slipping my mind there.
Hence, having Robert De Niro in it.
It definitely looks interesting. I just don't know how. I don't know how I feel about it. Like, I don't know what the movie's doing, so
we'll
see. I'll probably go see it next week.
Wednesday's the start of the London Film Festival, and we're off for 10 days and watching like 34 movies, so we're going to try and squeeze it in if we've got a gap, because it releases next Friday in the UK. That plus Downton. It's going to be a lot of movies.
I think we're going to do Mindhunter Season 2 at some point.
Yeah, that's one of the ones I was talking about.
Oh, really? Is Vali actually going to like host it and edit it this time?
I don't know.
Are we waiting on you?
We talked about it.
Watched it though, Bina.
I've watched it. I watched it like first weekend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well then. I
hadn't even watched the first season. I finally watched them both, so.
Yeah,
I thought it was a documentary thing. I actually didn't realize what it was before.
I would strongly encourage people to watch The Politician. I binge-watched that today. It's like a mashup of Election and The Royal Tenenbaums. It's very...
I heard that's great.
You have to go with it. It's very stupid and silly, but it's also
for
the Vali on point.
The teaser in the cinema yesterday when watching Downton Abbey, one of the teasers was for The Politician, and I thought, I don't think I want to watch that, but now I might be changing my mind.
It's very particular. If you want to see Gwyneth Paltrow playing basically Margot Tenenbaum 20 years later, having a lesbian affair with the real life Martina Navratilova, if you want to see Bette Midler as a campaign manager, I mean, like, everybody is in it. Jessica Lange, I mean, it's just insane.
I saw that, I was like, I guess I have to see this, like, the cast.
But I think you really do need to be up on pop culture. Like, there's some twins in there that really look like the twins.
I feel like I'm not going to get the references.
But it's very funny, I think. Thank you so much to all of you for joining. It was just so lovely doing another linear reread after a long time for me, and also just such great chapters. So thank you to Hannah, Adam, Mikhail, James, Jock, Mary, Michael, Carl Bodega, we missed you. And I can't wait to hear the next one as well. This is exciting. Like, we're pushing into the final furlong of Dance. I feel it's going to be big events, characters having their final chapters, big speculation about what's happening next. It should be quality from here on in.
Yeah.
I hear something big happens at the end with John, but I don't know for sure.
No spoilers.
What?
I forgot.
Quentin alive. I can't wait. I'm hosting that episode just so I can say that every 5 minutes. I didn't see a chain of evidence. It ain't happening. Okay. Have a wonderful rest of the weekend, guys, and speak to you soon.
Thank you. You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, Bina. Later.
I woke up this morning, around for my shoes, her bag I did, whoa, walking through her, but this morning, being around for my shoes, but you know about it, I got to eat, oh, walking through. my lonesome home. Well, I got up this morning. All I had was gone. Well, be this morning if I have to. Well, ride the blind. I'll be mistreated enough. Don't mind dying. Leave this morning. On a dollar, whoa.